You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, Mauricio Macri is sworn in as Argentina's new president, but will the ghosts of the Kirchners haunt his leadership? Jeffrey Kaufman and Ivor Gaber will give us their thoughts on this and the day's other top stories. We'll be discussing the latest news from Paris as the climate negotiations take another turn. And also ahead, an Iranian newspaper defies all norms and publishes a front-page editorial condemning state censorship. And it seems that the world has finally had enough of Donald Trump, hallelujah, as brands around the globe start taking down his names from buildings and indeed from shelves. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Jeffrey Kaufman and Ivor Gaber. Jeffrey Kaufman is an author and commentator, and Ivor Gaber is a professor of journalism at the University of Sussex. We start today's programme with a look at COP21 and the ongoing quest to reach a deal on climate change. While there is hope that a meaningful agreement will come out of the Paris meeting, we still haven't seen any significant moves. However, earlier today, the United States announced that together with over 100 other countries, it has joined a high ambition coalition. So no commitment, but an ambition. Jeffrey Kaufman, the obvious question, I guess, is this a cop-out?
That is just too cute for a very serious subject, Steve. I'm going to scold you for that. It's what I like to call a definite maybe. There's good intention here, but you know, the actions are incredibly expensive and will affect our lifestyles, our industrial base. But you know, to me, what's been happening on the other side of the planet this week really underlines that this is ultimately, it's important that all of us try to reform our lifestyles. But the bottom line is, this comes down to two countries. This is about the United States and it's about China. And the reason is that if you look at the numbers of the top 10 greenhouse, the top 10 countries emit 70% of the greenhouse gases in this planet. China alone is responsible for 24%, the U.S. for 12%. No other country comes close. India would be the third as an individual country at 6%. But, you know, China this week had this extraordinary smog alert in Beijing, 40 times the acceptable level of the World Health Organization. I mean, this is a country whose industrial growth and its ambition is fueled on coal. And while we can do our noble bits by recycling our tuna tins and our milk cartons, that is not going to save the planet. China reforming its bad habits and the U.S. weaning itself off the car or finding an alternative to internal combustion, that's what it's really about.
What's interesting, though, with China is that there is a clear difference between, and we'll talk about what happened in Copenhagen in 2009 in a moment, but the attitude that China is taking towards this issue now compared to 2009 is incomparable, isn't it? And as we've already seen earlier this year with the US and China striking their own deal pre-Paris, there is an acceptance, it seems, amongst the Chinese elite, who, of course, you know, air is the one thing that you can't buy your own of, on the whole.
Well, you also can't, you know, I mean... It is a little bit sardonic. You can't actually claim that the sun is shining when you can't see 5 feet in front of you. And you know, in fact, somebody from University College London, UCL, who I'm collaborating with in their computer science department, was there this week. He came back early. His entire team was having respiratory problems, and they left on Tuesday of this week. And he said he had never experienced a hell like that. And they canceled all their meetings. They just said, this is not worth staying in town for. I mean, the reality is that, you know, governments, authoritarian governments like you have in China can tell a lot of lies, create a lot of mythologies. But when people can't breathe and can't send their children to kindergarten, can't go on the street, when cars are banned, you know you have a big problem. And China has to now acknowledge it. And so you're right, there is a shift, but the shift is staring them in the face and it's in their lungs.
When we look at this this high ambition coalition that has been announced, and we could applaud the wordplay if nothing else, does this give you a small modicum of hope that we will see some sort of decent deal emerge from these negotiations in Paris?
You know, the question I have, and I'm not a climate scientist, is it too late? You know, of course we have to try. But the consequences of climate change, we're just seeing them across the planet. And of course, it's not an absolute clear science, but it is absolutely clear that we're seeing sea temperatures rising. We're seeing communities close to sea level flooding, and we're seeing dramatic shifts in climate. And it's just, we know that CO2 is damaging our atmosphere. The question is, we are now at such a rapacious industrial pace, can we really re-engineer in time? I mean, we're talking about correcting course incrementally, when what we really need is a complete change of course.
We often see during these negotiations that there is a difference between the richer countries and the poorer countries in terms of what should be done, because obviously the poorer countries tend to be those that A, haven't done much to cause climate change in the first place, and yet B, many of them are those that are going to be most deeply affected.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's actually, I think I would take issue with what you just said. I think it is true that the richest countries, in particular the U.S., you know, are massive consumers of hard goods, but also massive users of the automobile. But, you know, if you look at that list of the top 10 users after the China and the USA at 12%, the entire EU is responsible for 9% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. But then you get into India, 6%, Brazil, 6%, Russia, 5%. I mean, you know, India and Brazil are by any definition developing countries. And, you know, their economies are based on using not necessarily the most efficient sources of energy. India in particular uses a lot of coal. So the problem, of course, is that for a country like India, it's very hard to find alternatives. I think the other thing that you see when you go to, as I have, to so many developing countries or underdeveloped countries in general, is that while packaged goods are not as prolific as they are here in Europe or in North America, the disposal of consumer waste is just horrifying in places like Karachi or New Delhi. And that too is just absolutely souring. How much of this can the ocean take? How much can the rivers take? And so developed nations do play a big role in affecting the oceans and in affecting the environment. So you get almost an extreme of the richest and some of the, if not the poorest, the most populous.
I should just say the reason why I haven't turned to Ivor Gaber is because he's stuck on a train on his way here, but he will join us.
I was just monopolizing the conversation.
Well, I mean, yeah, that can happen as well. He will be joining us at some stage. Jeffrey, to look at the diplomatic angle of this, as we said, you know, back in 2009, you had essentially a colossal failure at the talks in Copenhagen. And it was symbolized, if you like, by the fact that it ended with Barack Obama negotiating essentially one-on-one with a Chinese official, not with the Chinese premier who'd been there, but just with an official. Do you get the sense that there is, around all sides of the table now, there is a sort of a renewed seriousness this time around?
I think there is. I think that I think that just incrementally over the years that have passed, we've seen more and more evidence that's irrefutable, unless you're within a certain Republican stripe of the American politics, where there's still a huge amount of denial about evolution and climate change. I think that there is now a broad consensus that something has to be done, and I would say two things on this. One, it's fine to say something has to be done, but as we've already established, the intention and action are very far apart still. And I think the second thing is were we to see a political change of stripe in the White House, we have a whole series of candidates running for the Republican nomination who are not going to be sympathetic to climate change and who believe that it is just one of those left-wing myths that should be ignored or put down. And so that would be a huge setback for those who believe that climate change really is an existential question for us.
Okay, let's move on from climate change to a change in power. Argentina's new leader, Mauricio Macri, has been sworn in as the country's new president, but it was a somewhat troubled transition into power. The former president, Cristina Kirchner, boycotted the ceremony and instead yesterday, in her parting speech, lauded her government's achievements, understandable, while blasting the incoming administration. And Jeffrey Kaufman, not even just that, she also essentially encouraged her supporters, 100,000 of them who were gathered there, to be prepared to take to the streets waving their national flags if they were betrayed, something which she seemed to suggest was either going to happen or had happened already.
You know, I covered Latin America for 10 years for ABC News, so this is a story very close to my heart, and I feel a bit like it's the resurrection of Eva Perón. This is the demagogue not wanting to leave the presidential palace. It is an extraordinary story to read about, to listen to what she said and the way she behaved. It is an absolute confirmation that she's a petty, small-minded, greedy, and ultimately self-absorbed leader who has no sense of the grand. Of the grand sweep of age and time, and who believes that her own indispensability is more important than her country's health. I mean, it is extraordinary the way she has behaved. She has refused to attend the inauguration of her successor. I mean, talk about sour grapes. She, of course, was termed out. She under the Argentine Constitution, she could only serve two terms, and so herself, her appointed successor, anointed, I should say, successor, was to take over and carry on the Kirchner flag. He lost in the second round by 3% to Mauricio Macri, and she just can't believe that the Argentines don't still love Kirchnerismo, which is the politics of that she and her late husband Nestor created over the last 12 years in Argentina. The pettiness is just staggering, and the self-absorption. You have to hope that Mauricio Macri can do what he says he wants to do, and that is to be the president of all Argentines.
It's interesting as well because, you know, let's face it, Mauricio Macri is not necessarily the perfect president himself, is he? He's been, you know, there's been many people who have criticised his rule of Buenos Aires when he was mayor. There are many people also say that he has links to various different organisations that perhaps may now have too much power. Yet, is it arguable that Cristina Kirchner's actions are making him look far more moderate than perhaps his politics might be?
Absolutely. I mean, except for the extreme, the hard Kirchner supporters, the hardline supporters, it very much. I mean, I think unless you're blind, the kind of the actions that she has taken and her refusal to cooperate in the succession really underline that this is a cancer on Argentine politics. I mean, you know, step back for a moment and look at Argentina's place in history. In 1900, it had one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It has this staggering wealth of silver. It has the pampas with, you know, enormous grazing grounds, wheat. It is abundant. In fact, it very much in 1900 was the Canada of South America and had an economic growth rate, a GDP comparable to Canada's, and a lifestyle.
You're saying Canada in a good way there, aren't you?
I am. As a Canadian, I am saying it in a good way. Weren't they lucky? No. But quite seriously, I mean, Argentina in 1900 was one of the countries with great promise in the 20th century. And through largely through political corruption and ineptitude and demagoguery, it has utterly been hijacked. And there is no reason why this country is a poor, corrupt, inefficient country that lingers on the margins of the world. It is so positioned to be a strong power. It has the natural resources, the economic base to do that. It's very far from everywhere, but of course, in 100 years, distance has diminished, and so that issue, which was one of the reasons it was marginalized, has diminished as well. it is, I think, one of the most frustrating stories of the 20th century. And it goes back to Juan Perón, Eva Perón, and the success of the dictatorship in the 1980s. It has just been so mismanaged. Its judiciary is corrupt. Its government is corrupt. The entire system is broken. It is an enchanting place to visit. You know, everyone who goes to Buenos Aires goes, oh my gosh, it is fabulous. I love it. But when you look below the surface, when you scratch just a little bit, you realize it is a completely broken country. You can only hope that Mauricio Macri will be able to bring it back and help it move forward.
How does that happen then? Well, in this situation where you've had, you know, a divided, you know, obviously all elections prove that a nation is divided, but this is seems sort of more, the division is sort of more polarized than perhaps in other nations. How do you begin to rebuild that country and rebuild the economy, and also, you know, those things that you've mentioned there, rebuild people's trust in institutions?
Right. So there are two things I would say to that. One is that under Kirchnerismo, under the two Kirchners, the country moved away from free markets and into government intervention, government nationalization. You know, it depends on your politics. If you believe that is a good approach, then they did a good job. But the, you know, inflation is, I think, officially at 15%, but unofficially and probably more realistically at 25%. That is not a good legacy that Cristina can leave. You know, Macri has promised to push towards free markets. The other area is that under the Kirchners, Argentina sided with the left-wing leaders of South America, Evo Morales in Bolivia, and more importantly, Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez, in Venezuela. Macri has said no more. In fact, he wants Chavez marginalized by the OAS, or not Chavez, but his successor,
Maduro.
So what he has said is that Macri wants to reopen the dialogue with the United States and European countries in a way that it hasn't been under the Kirchners. Will that lead to economic reform? There is an opportunity to press the restart button. Mm. I guess that's where we are. But we know from experience that it's always exciting the day of the inauguration, because anything's possible, and it's, you know, we can dream, we can have the audacity of hope, and often those expectations are dashed. As you point out, Macri is an imperfect man in an imperfect country, so you know there is that horrible saw of journalism: only time will tell. In this case, I'm afraid it's true. You know, let's see how he does, but certainly. There is a moment, there is the opportunity to hope here.
When you look more broadly across Latin America, obviously you have Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia. You have a relatively new president in Mexico, who again was sort of seen as a bit of a new broom. Is it too much to sort of see there's a little bit of a sweep of some sort of change happening through Latin America, which isn't of the change that we saw in the last decade of this sort of switch to the more populist left?
I don't think that I would agree with that overall. I think that the important change in Latin America goes back to the 1970s, when the vast majority of countries were dictatorships. And today, even though you have countries like Venezuela that are unstable democracies, of the 35, 36 countries in the Western Hemisphere, only one is officially a dictatorship, and that would still be Cuba. You know, so many of the countries like Argentina and Brazil that were under dictatorship, are emerging democracies. They're unstable. Democracy is not an overnight process, as we have well seen in Iraq, and as we see in Western countries that struggle. But I think that these are evolutionary swings of the pendulum. I think the important thing is that we do see democracy, and the really encouraging thing in Argentina, you know, the takeaway is that democracy actually worked. She was termed out. Cristina had to acknowledge it. She didn't try to do an end run. We saw that in Colombia, by the way, when Alvaro Uribe was termed out, and he tried to get the Supreme Court of Colombia a few years ago to extend him to a third term because he believed he was so indispensable. And they said no. And, you know, he was stunned that the judges that he appointed overruled his vision. And
although his chosen successor did then actually win, not that she did him any good because they fell out with each other 18 months later.
Exactly, they fell out. So his, you know, careful who you choose to carry on your legacy. But, you know, I think that those kind of institutional victories are very important in emerging democracies. And for Colombia, a country that I think is one of the most interesting to watch because, you know, its civil war has come to an end and it has such a strong industrial base and so much potential for growth, to see, you know, in that case, the judiciary overrule a very powerful, very popular president was significant. And in this case, you know, to see the electoral system, which is inevitably in these countries, having covered elections in these countries, inevitably riven with corruption, but still struggles. I mean, even in Venezuela, where I covered elections, it was incredibly impressive how diligent they were putting everybody's finger in purple ink so that they couldn't vote twice.
Always important. We'll leave it there just for now. Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. When we're back, we'll be discussing, well, a couple of other things. Stay tuned.
Get ready for the latest in our brilliant news series with the Monocle Travel Guide to Hong Kong. There is much more to Hong Kong than its sea of skyscrapers. It's a global hub that welcomes visitors, and you should be next. We'll point you where to go if you're in the mood for bao or burgers, and where to stay if you want to get away from the centre of town. There are runs and hikes to refresh you after a long flight, plus essays from Hong Kongers who have witnessed the city's drastic changes over the past decade. Published by Gestalten, our travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. The Monocle Travel Guide to Hong Kong. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guest today, Jeffrey Kaufman. Let's turn now to a media story. In an unprecedented move, the Iranian newspaper Etalat has condemned media censorship in the country in a rare front page editorial. The editor has urged President Hassan Rouhani to intervene against the state's ban on publishing the name or the images of the former reformist president, Mohammad Khatami. Jeffrey Kaufman, this is a rare good news story about media freedom.
And a rare good news about democratic values flowering in the Middle East and the Arab world. It's a really interesting story. I mean, this guy is gutsy, and it does speak. You know, we were just talking about Latin America, about political institutions, and, you know, the Constitution of Iran does guarantee freedom of the press. Of course, in practice, it's one of the most oppressive places for journalists.
Yeah, hasn't really been tested in a good way very well recently.
Exactly, and so, you know, we have every reason to be cynical when dozens of journalists and bloggers are behind bars, and, you know, the BBC's Persian service can't go to Iran without fear of arrest.
And of course, there's the case of Jason Rezaian of the Washington Post, who's been held in jail under charges which, you know, even now
for spying, for more than a year, exactly. So, you know, it does seem a bit incongruous that an editor who actually lives in Tehran and works for a newspaper that is really not known to take strong political stands against the government has defied the court and mentioned Mohammad Khatami's name not once but three times in the last couple of days. It's a fascinating case of, oh.
And it would be interesting to see exactly how it plays out. And I think one of the things that strikes me about this is that often newspapers that take these sorts of risks, they need others to then follow it. There needs to be a ripple effect. And often you find that there'll be a brave newspaper, be it here or maybe like in Nigeria, doing something about corruption, but there'll be no ripple effect because all the others will ignore it.
Well, I think that is what we need to watch over the next couple of weeks. You know, will this lead to anything beyond? You know, will he be arrested, or will there actually be some sort of fallout from this as others pick up the mantle? Other media organizations in Iran start mentioning Khatami's name, even though the court has said that it is banned. You know, that's really going to be the test of the true significance of this in time.
Let's turn to Donald Trump. Now, yesterday on Midori...
No.
We should have done this earlier.
There's so much to say.
No, there really isn't. Yesterday on Midori House, I declared this program a Trump-free zone because I'm frankly tired of him. However, this is a good story about Donald Trump because it seems as if the rest of the world...
Oh, you're part of the left-wing media conspiracy, he would say, when you say a good story that tarnishes his name.
Yeah, that basically sort of takes his
on
words...
On behalf of the hair dye makers of the world, I want to just say that.
Well, it seems as if other parts of the world, unlike parts of America, are beginning to get fed up with Mr. Trump, and his comments, his anti-Muslim comments, have been costing him a bit more than he might have expected. In the Middle East, a major chain of department stores has halted all sales of the items of the Trump Home line. I mean, frankly, who knew there was a Trump Home line? Who was buying those in the first place?
I think it's mirrors.
Fair enough. On top of this, it seems that public officials in Vancouver and Toronto are considering removing his name from hotel skyscrapers. A golf course in Dubai has taken the brand name down too. And here in the UK, I'm not sure what you think of this, Jeffrey, but more than 250,000 Brits have signed a petition demanding that Trump be barred from entering the country. I'm not entirely sure if the threat of one ban should be met by a threat of another.
Well, I think so. I think, the idea of removing Trump's name from Trump hotels in Toronto and Vancouver and banning him here would be to play Trump demagoguery and, in reverse. So, it's a nice protest and it's a good way to vent for local politicians.
I would far rather he was actually invited here and made to walk around the streets of London and we could all jeer and boo him.
But I think that the more serious one is the reaction in the Arab world, and the Arab world has every reason to be deeply offended by this just blatant racism, and some call fascism, and it's not far off fascism.
It is fascism.
Yeah, it really is in so many ways. I think that what's interesting here is that in a region that doesn't have a lot of accountability, in a region where a lot of deals are done discreetly and under the table and in questionable circumstance, and in a region where transparency is just not a norm, suddenly you've got this issue of these Trump brands in places like Dubai staring you in the face, a man who has said, I want to ban you from coming to my country if I become president. And this is no longer an elephant in the room. This is an elephant walking down the main streets of the Arab world. That's a terrible. I apologize to the listeners on that. I think I just completely mangled that.
The analogies, but we got the
idea. Yeah,
at what stage do you think Donald Trump, the businessman, thinks that Donald Trump, the politician, has caused a bit too much trouble? Because not only are there these things here,
I think he's having so much fun.
He's lost his program on NBC.
He doesn't care. He doesn't care. He's got enough money, and he's got. Listen, this is a guy. Do not. Let's look in January. If his poll numbers don't drop because of the outrageous things he said in the last week, I think there's a. I would put good money on his chances of getting the Republican nomination. From the beginning of this, people have said, oh, he's a flash in the pan. It's just a phenomenon. And we've all, those who find him offensive have been prepared to say, oh, he's going to fade. And, Marco Rubio will eclipse him. Jeb Bush, I think he's killed Jeb Bush's chances. I think it's fair to say that Jeb Bush will go to his grave with resenting Donald Trump.
Being remembered as the less smart Bush brother.
Right, right. Certainly the less charismatic one. But I think that his durability should give us cause to take him seriously as a candidate. The question is, with these latest comments, is that enough for the Republican Party membership to walk from him and move?
Last time around, there was always someone who was, let's be polite and say, less mainstream, who was leading the Republican nomination. Until eventually it was like, okay, let's find the nearest person who's vaguely electable, Mitt Romney, it's him. So it was Rick Santorum, it was Newt Gingrich at one stage, it was Herman Cain. Remember Herman Cain, the pizza guy? He was leading the polls at one stage.
Hey, remember Ben Carson? I mean, he was doing well too until he opened his mouth.
Well, yes. Surely the point here, there's an argument here that there is always someone who is outside the mainstream who is leading. It just happens to have been Donald Trump the entire time.
I think that what's happened, listen, I've been part of the American media establishment, so to speak. I'm not sure I wanted to admit it, what I just said, but I have been for 20 years. And, you know, as American mainstream media has become more and more inane and trivial, you know, the discourse has become this sort of confrontational, you know, you're good, you're bad, I'm good. And so don't confuse me with facts. And Trump is the result of that. So I think the discourse can't deal in nuance. And here's a man who doesn't speak in nuance.
There we are. Jeffrey Kaufman, a man who does speak in nuance and has done very well for the last half hour. Thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for on Midori House. It was produced by Colossus Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Stay tuned. Lots of music next. Then it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Midori House, back same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.